Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Hey there, Marky.
Hey, Francis. How are you this morning?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Doing pretty well. I was reading through the Times magazine a few weeks back, and I found a word which really, I think, says it all about me. It was a self-describing word that
idiot?
I found.
Idiot is in there?
Why you got to be like that?
I'm sorry. That was mean-spirited.
Happy, good morning to you, too, Francis.
Sorry. That was mean-spirited, and I take it back. Mostly.
Anyway, I was reading the talk column, which sometimes comes up with words. And sometimes the words are real words, and sometimes the words are just kind of words invented by the restaurant industry. And the word that caught my attention was condomaniac. And I thought, condomaniac,
C-O-N-D-I-M-A-N-I-A-C. Oh, I thought it was...
Yeah, that's it. By the way, I did a double take.
I was like,
when I first saw the word, I was like, hold on.
By the way, you got four kids.
We can't talk about that on a food show.
You got four kids. You can't be the condomaniac.
I can be now. Okay. Anyway, I'll read you the definition. A person affected by a mania for condiments. One whose cabinet and refrigerator doors are filled with an excess of food seasonings. Used in a sentence, he's such a condomaniac, he brought his own Dijon grainy and violet mustards to the barbecue.
That's you, pretty much. That's you, pretty much.
Well, I like my sauces, I like my condoms, I like... Hey, now, condiments. See what you made me do.
Put that
you
in your
see
head.
What you made me do.
I use the Jedi mind trick.
I like my condiments. And, you know, something's always better if you can dip it into something else. It started when I was about 8 years old with potato chips, and we've just moved along from there.
I'm in. Speaking of potato chips, I'm a big fan of the making your own fresh-made potato chips. And I have to say, French onion dip. I like it.
It's what's not to like.
I like it. It reminds me of being a kid and sneaking down to my parents' party and having some.
I admit it, and I admit I'm not the 99-cent whatever sour cream dip tastes good. I cannot tell a lie.
I saw that article, the talk article this week in the Times, or last week in the Times, and they talked about a couple of other words, and one is a misunderstood word that we actually use a lot now that we have our Italian restaurant, and they talk about the Italian word salumi. And people often say to me in the restaurant, they say, you mean salami? And the answer is sort of.
Yes. Yes, you do.
Salumi, just so you know, is an Italian word that means basically any salt-cured meat product. Mm-hmm. I think it's beef or pork. So all of the sausages like salami, prosciutto, coppa, lardo, bracciole, those are all salumi. Mm-hmm. And you'll find them in a store that sells different kinds of salumi, including salami. It's called a salumeria. So we use a salami shop.
Mm-hmm.
So salumi and salami related, not the same word, but you see salumi a lot more, especially as people...
Well, salumi is a broader category, and salami is one of the items in... of salumi.
Well, and it's funny because Mario Batali, in his restaurant empire, his father is makes a lot of the salumi for his restaurants.
But I love that he did that after. Like, you think of Mario Batali, and you think of his father being like this great, you know, obviously culinary guidance to Mario. And really what ended up happening is Mario became this great culinary legend, and his father said, I'd really love to like make salumi. I think I'm going
to
go do it.
And went to Italy and learned how to do it.
Yeah.
Makes it some of the best salumi in America. But so we have a guy who makes the salumi for us, particularly, and makes it on a regular basis.
One of the guys who works for us, it's his uncle, an old Italian guy who's been making salumi since before I was born.
And this guy, the young cook who was working for us, said, "You know, my uncle just got off the boat a couple of years ago, but his own Saloon Maria. Do you want him to make stuff for you?" yes,
which is actually cool because we actually have sent him some of our own things to cure for us and to make into salumi, and he's got all the aging facilities there. So it's really given us a chance to carry some interesting things.
So let's get that word right, salumi. The other one that they make, I can't believe that this has become so out in the open.
It is out. They have been outed.
It's called bean to bar, and bean to bar is the chocolate making process is very complicated, and there are two parts to it. And the first is
there are lots of parts to it, but there are two
main parts.
Very distinctive parts to it.
One is to make the chocolate itself that you then melt down to make into bonbons or molded chocolate or to any of the other many things that you use chocolate for. However, to get to that and to get from beans, cocoa beans, to that piece of chocolate that then gets melted down and is used as the basic building blocks of the things that you make with chocolate, a chocolatier or a chocolatier usually takes that chocolate, that piece of chocolate.
Sounds like you can also storm the castle.
That's a musketeer.
Oh, okay.
And a
okay.
Mousketeer would be what an F and Cello.
Oh,
But the chocolatier it takes this basic chocolate. Most chocolatiers are not chocolate makers. They don't make, or a bonbonnier, they don't make the chocolate couverture. And that's what it's called. It's called a couverture itself. They'll either buy a couverture from one company or buy several couvertures and make their own blend. Well, a couple of companies go bean to bar.
And their job is to temper the chocolate and to mold it into whatever you want it molded into, mix it with whatever
flavors
they're going to mix it.
Make the truffles or make whatever.
Give it the texture that you want. It's a very complex thing to do that part of the process.
But to get from bean to couverture is a manufacturing process. It means you start with cocoa beans, vanilla, cocoa butter, additional cocoa butter, and maybe sugar. And that's a very basic process. Well, most places aren't bean to bar. What's funny is there was this Noka chocolate, N-O-K-A.
Super expensive. Thousands of dollars a pound.
Touted as the most expensive chocolate in the world at $2,000 a pound. And they were really sort of oblique about whether they were bean to bar or not, what made their chocolate so expensive. They were on the talk show circuit. They were a very successful company at, are you ready for this? $2,000 a pound for their finished chocolates. Well, one food blogger, I think, was it San Francisco?
From California. You said they came from Finland? Finished chocolate. I'm sorry.
Finished chocolate.
Oh, okay.
So what he did was he looked at what their ingredient list was and figured out that they weren't bean to bar, and he figured out indeed that they were using Bonat, which is one of the main chocolate makers that makes the chocolate couverture.
A very nice chocolate couverture, by the way.
They were just taking the Bonat chocolate couverture, which you can get for a few bucks a pound. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what it is. $10 a pound?
Yep.
Something crazy like that. And then melting it down and making it, and this blogger says, poorly into mediocre chocolates, but it was all about branding, and they were selling it in tiny little 3/4 ounce boxes to what amounted to $2,000 a pound, and that food blog was the most emailed food blog I've ever seen. Everybody knows about it, and Noka
pretty much everybody I know in the restaurant business has seen that blog.
Total ripoff Noka chocolate.
So they've been outed.
They've been at it.
They've been
and
at
so
it.
In the bean-to-bar definition, in the talk of the times, they actually mention some people even fake bean-to-bar, like Noka chocolate. In
Ouch.
The Times, Christine Mielke.
Ouch.
Pretty interesting. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi Restaurant. We are being joined again by who's becoming a regular guest on this show, Natalie McLean. Natalie McLean has the website Nat Decants. She's also written the book Red, White, and Drunk All Over, A Wine-Soaked Journey from Grape to Glass. She's one of the world's most respected regular writers and journalists on food and wine.
Natalie, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Mark and Francis. How are you?
We're doing great. Really good to talk to you again.
Oh, nice to talk to you guys, too.
Well, we get your newsletter, and actually, if you want to find out and get Natalie's newsletter, you can get it by going to natdecanse.com. Now, you're a Canadian wine and food writer, which means that you don't write exclusively about Canadian wine, but you do have a passion for Canadian wine. Isn't that so?
I do. You know, we've got a vibrant, thriving, but small industry here, and so we're renowned for our ice wines, but we also make some terrific dry Rieslings and Pinot Noir, and we're driving distance from New Jersey, too.
Well, most of our fans don't know that I was actually born in Canada. So.
Oh, really?
So,
whereabouts?
Yeah, I was born in Montreal.
Oh, my goodness.
Way back when. My dad was working for General Foods up there, and so that's from where I came.
Surrounded by Canucks, I am.
moved here very early in my life. We moved back to the States.
Now, is the wine industry in Canada, Natalie, a tourist destination? One of the things that's happened around here, I think the most vibrant East Coast wine destination right now is Long Island, both because of the quality of what they're producing and because of their proximity to New York. I was out on Long Island. A friend of ours, Barbara Shin and David Page of Home Restaurant and now Shin Vineyards in Long Island. They have, I think, one of the best vineyards out on Long Island. And they opened a B&B, and they did a friends and family run where they invited me and a couple of friends up for the weekend to just sort of test everything out. I know it's a hard job, but somebody's got to do it. I was really glad to help them out while they made me breakfast. But there was actually so much traffic on the main road in Matatuck, and there were limousines and buses, and I felt like I was in Napa Valley.
Wow.
Is there that kind of tourist draw to Canadian wine destinations?
There is. It may not be as busy as that region, but definitely Niagara offers a lot in addition to the wineries. A lot of the wineries, of course, have fabulous restaurants attached, so the wine and dining scene is very much complete. But it's a beautiful region for camping, picnicking, that sort of thing. And then it also has the largest George Bernard Shaw Festival in the summer, which attracts thousands of people. So right in Niagara on the lake, there's the Playhouse. There's several theaters going concurrently all the time. So a lot of people will plan a whole vacation around that between all of those aspects that it has to offer. So, yeah, we're getting lots of tourists that way.
Well, let's talk about world wine now, and the Canadian wine market is very similar to the American wine market. And, you know, we're talking about the Niagara region being in the Northeast. We have a similar climate.
Yours is a little colder. I can attest to that, Natalie.
Yes. One of the few blessings of having a consistently cold climate is that we are the world's largest ice wine producer. I keep telling you that myself that in the middle of March.
Natalie, all the pictures of me as a two-year-old, I'm very bundled.
Yeah. See two little eyes peeking out.
Well, one of the things that a restaurateur named Paul Greco, who's a friend of ours, and he owns a restaurant called Hearth, and he now has a new restaurant. But one of the things that he does, he's an innovative wine sommelier and wine salesman. He works the floor of his own restaurant. One of the things that he does is he arranges his wine list seasonally. And so he'll say, these are the wines for summer, these are the wines for fall. And then, you know, as the seasons pass, he'll put wines on sale that are sort of going out of season. Well, that's a very interesting way of looking at it. I think almost any wine you can have in any season of the year. But there are certain wines that go with the seasons. You have a take on that as well. Why don't you share it with us?
Sure. I think there's two factors to consider when we think about winter wines versus summer wines. And I think about them maybe like your winter wardrobe and your summer wardrobe. So you want to put away all the woolly sweaters. And woolly sweaters in the world of wine are your big, heavy, alcoholic wines that will warm you up in the winter, go with hearty, you know, meats and warm dishes. But in the summer, I think the last thing you want to be sipping out on the deck when it's, you know, really hot outside is a hot alcoholic wine. So that's one factor. We're looking for lighter wines.
But Natalie, in when I wear my winter clothes, I'm mostly just trying to cover up the extra 15 pounds.
I can't help you.
Well, no. But let's talk for those who might know the kind of wines that Natalie's talking about, big alcoholic wines. And wines can really vary in alcohol. I mean, a German Riesling might be 7, 8, 9% alcohol, and a Cabernet from California might be 15.5%.
Or a Zinfandel alcohol might get up to 16.
I know, so, there's such a range these days.
Well, but you as wine drinkers need to be aware when you're drinking wine, especially considering drinking and driving and how you want it to affect you and how alcohol affects you in the heat. having, you can have two bottles of German wine and have the same amount of alcohol enter your system as one bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon if it's a very powerful Cabernet Sauvignon. So that's the kind of thing Natalie's talking about. So
absolutely.
So we put away those big woolly sweaters, and what kind of wines do we look for in the summer?
Well, and the bonus is that, you know, if we do go for the crisp, lighter wines, they go with the foods of summer. So if you take that German Riesling or other crisp whites, they're going to go really, really well with our summer salads, our seafood, grilled veggies. Those are all nice pairings because of the complementary flavors and weight, both of the wine and the food.
Well, we eat lighter in the summer.
I also, yeah. We need to take a quick break, but I want to come back and talk with you about vegetables, which you mentioned, which we hopefully should be eating a lot of, but which actually are not the easiest things in the world to match with wine. We'll be talking about that very topic when we come back with Natalie McLean of natdecanse.com, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're here with one of our favorite wine experts, Natalie McLean. Her website is natdecanse.com. You can go right there or link to it through our site at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. And we're talking about the wines of summer. Specifically before the break, Natalie, we were talking about pairing up wine with vegetables, and that presents us with some unique problems, doesn't it?
It does. I love veggies. And, you know, as a determined hedonist, I will not give up on wine with vegetables. But you've got a couple challenges. First of all, red meats tend to go with wine because they have proteins in them. The proteins in the meat will bind and dance beautifully with the tannins, say, in a red wine. In veggies, you don't have proteins. You have herbaceous flavors. You've got a range of acidity, very challenging elements for wine.
Well, I mean, things like artichokes foil almost every wine in the world.
Well, that's a special case. Let's talk about that after the break, because that's a really cool thing, what goes on with artichokes.
It does.
But vegetables in general, what should we be looking to? Because people are going to be listening to the show, going to go to the liquor store and look for a bottle of wine, or go to a restaurant and look to order a bottle of wine. What should we be looking for with our crudité, with our vegetable plates? What should we be looking for?
Sure.
Summer by the pool.
Exactly. So we're going to knock out the really tannic wines, the alcoholic and oaky wines, because they're going to clobber vegetables.
So even big oaky Chardonnays we should avoid.
I would, unless you're talking about a starchy vegetable like pumpkin or squash or potato, but those are kind of winter vegetables
anyway.
Which are more
fall winter.
Yeah, exactly. So if we're talking about the green veggies, we're going to look for crisp. White wines tend to do better than red wines because of the lack of tannins. But also we're going to look for white wines that have an herbaceous herbal character themselves. So I think of Austrian Grüner Veltliner as a good choice.
Excellent.
Yes. My favorite, in fact, I call it the veggie wine of the century, is New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
It's like summer salad in a glass, in liquid form.
So what people need to get over, I think a lot of people out there have this idea that for it to be a delicious quality wine, you know, you put your nose in the glass of that Kendall Jackson Chardonnay and you smell that oak.
Yes.
That may work on its own and be something that you like, but it may get a little messed up when you have that with vegetables. And maybe a Sauvignon Blanc doesn't immediately appeal to you when you put your nose in the glass because it smells a little grapefruity and it doesn't have that familiar oak.
And sometimes it'll have those grassy notes to it, too, but those grassy notes happen to go great with vegetables.
Exactly. So it may not be the wine by itself you may not like as well, but when you have it with your dinner, you need to be a little more careful and at least have a bottle of that around. Hey, we need to go to the news, but when we come back, we're going to be talking more with Natalie McLean about the wines of summer and what you should be looking for poolside and in your local restaurant. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Natalie McLean is one of the foremost wine journalists. She's written for over the 60 magazines. Her own website is Nat Decants. You can find it at natdecants.com. And her book is Red, White, and Drunk All Over, A Wine-Soaked Journey from Grape to Glass. We've been talking about pairing wines with the foods of summer, and vegetables are the problem children of wine matching in summertime. Mark mentioned earlier that artichokes are one of the most difficult wines foods to pair up with wine, and it's notoriously true. There was a reality show. I think it was Hell's Kitchen.
It was Top Chef. It was Top Chef first season.
There was one of the final challenges was to put together a food and wine extravaganza. You know, a whole dinner. And one of the finalists chose artichokes prominently in our dinner, and every wine person in the world smacked their head and said, "No, not artichokes."
If you remember Tiffany in the finals,
blew it on the artichokes.
She put artichoke. It was one of those things when, as you were watching her doing it, if you're a wine person,
right.
You
when
just
she
said,
conceptualized
the
menu, she said the word artichokes, and everybody went, "No, why are artichokes so difficult, Natalie?"
Well, they have an organic acid, cinnarin, that stimulates our taste buds' sugar receptors and fools us into thinking that everything we eat or drink afterwards is sweeter than it actually is, even water. So you can imagine how that plays havoc with wine. Every wine that you have after an artichoke is going to taste almost cloyingly sweet. And so the Italians are very clever, one of the world's largest producers of artichokes. They came up with a bitter-tasting aperitif called Cinar, but we can take a lesson, I think, from them in the style of wines that we choose with artichokes if we're bound and determined to have wine with them. And that is, look for austere, bone-dry whites. So from Italy, you could choose Verdicchio, or you could go with a Chablis from Burgundy, or even a Chenin Blanc from the Loire Valley. All of those are going to, because they're bone dry, they're going to come up a level in the sweetness perception, but they're going to go nicely, or as well as can be expected, with artichokes.
You know, just FYI to those of you out there, another great compliment with artichokes are cocktails. We make some cocktails with Cinar in them, and they actually it's a liqueur that comes from artichokes that goes great with artichokes.
I will tell you that liqueur, is it Cinar or Chinar? Do we know?
I hear both pronunciations. Not quite sure.
Well, it's one of those two.
Yeah.
But the liquor,
might be both of them.
I have to say, the liquor, we got it in for some cocktails. Actually, there was a cocktail in a book. We started using Chinar because it was in a book called Cocktails of New York, written by Anthony Giglio, and this is a cocktail that was come up at one of they came up with at one of Mario Batali's restaurants, and we really like it a lot. But when we ordered the Chinar, our liquor salesman, who we've been doing business with for 15 years, said, "Nobody's ordered that in the 15 years I've been here. Hold on a second. I think we have a case, and I think we had a case of Chinar from 1976.
I'm fairly certain that I was glad it was in a sealed
bottle.
We're
the only people using it, you know, except for, you know, in real Italian neighborhoods. But it's pretty amazing stuff. So artichokes, you want to go with bone dry because artichokes are going to make things taste sweeter. My view on artichokes is Grüner Veltliner is the only thing that really works with artichokes.
Yeah.
But we can also, when we have artichokes on a salad or something, how can we change it and prepare it differently to sort of mute the negative effects on wine a little bit?
Well, you can take the raw edge off artichokes by cooking them slowly in an acid-based liquid like lemon juice or vinegar or wine, and that's going to decrease that compound's content and turn the starches into sugar. So this will deepen their flavors and make them more wine-friendly. Or you could roast and caramelize them. That's all going to help and take that harsh edge off of them.
Well, now, let's turn our attention to, we're talking about the wines of summer. Let's think about how we drink the wines of summer. I mean, I pride myself on drinking many different ways, but in summertime we'll have people over in the backyard, and we want to crack some bottles of wine and have them out there. How do you suggest that if you're having wines at home that we deal with having wine available to serve to people, having it be the right temperature, having enough, do we leave our own corkscrew out there? Are we obligated to open the wines ourselves? How's it work?
Well, you know, I learned a valuable or expensive lesson a couple years back. When I had a casual outdoor gathering for about 30 people, and I set all the bottles of wine out on a table in the sun.
Lovely.
Yeah. And they were just, well-aged vinegar by the time the day was over. So these days I'll put out one bottle so people can feel that they, one bottle of red, one bottle of white, so that they feel that they can help themselves and don't have to keep asking, especially if it's a sort of milling around kind of gathering. But then I'll just keep replenishing them, but keep the white in an ice bucket and the red in the shade or in the house, because reds can get far too flabby and warm in the summer. Because you know that the that old advice about reds at room temperature, that goes back to, of course, medieval castles, and that was a lot cooler room,
right, the room
temperature.
The room was 68 degrees.
Exactly, exactly. And so a lot of reds in restaurants, some restaurants, are served too warm, and I'll have them put it in an ice bucket if that's the case. But that's a real consideration in the summertime when if you're just, you know, got the red out there on the deck, it can really heat up.
Well, we talk about the alcohol content and that we're looking for wines with lower alcohol in them. You take one of those wines that's even only 12-13% alcohol, and you put it in the sun and you warm it up to 70 or 80 degrees, well, all of a sudden you start perceiving a lot more of that alcohol.
Because the alcohol is volatile, and at that high temperature, the alcohol comes off the nose really quickly, plus the fruit gets all flabby and the tannin sort of fades.
Yep.
So temperature is really important. One of the things that I suggest people do with red wines, if you're having something in the backyard, it's not a bad idea to if you have a an ice bucket for the white wines, but if you have some sort of bucket or some sort of vessel and you can put a little layer of ice in the bottom of it and a little bit of water in the bottom of it and throw a towel over it
cool
to cover
water
it,
or something.
Yeah, the sun. It, you know, like you said, Natalie, to serve a red wine at 68, 65 degrees even, is delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Natalie, you talk about going to some restaurants where you ask them to put your red wine on ice. More than one time, somebody's looked at me like I'm from another planet because they served me a 78 degree bottle or worse,
wow,
bottle of red from
off the back of the bar
from their cellar, which happens to be next to the compressor for their refrigerator. And you know, they brought me some scaldingly hot bottle of red. Well, the only thing I can do that can possibly make that wine palatable is to put it in ice as quickly as I can and get it to the right temperature.
And out there in listener land, you'll often very see a wine knowledgeable person when a wine is presented to someone, they'll take their hand and put it on the bottle and touch it.
Right.
And the reason we do that is because sometimes you touch it and you realize it's 78 degrees. Now, if that's an old Burgundy, send it back and order a cheaper wine.
Exactly.
But if that's a, you know, a big cab or a Zinfandel and it's not too expensive, maybe it'll be okay. It certainly isn't better for having been at 75 degrees wherever they kept it. But you might say, you know what, just at that point, what I would do is say, you know, pour me a little taste to make sure the wine's okay, and then pour us all just a little teeny bit, and then put the bottle on ice for 5 minutes. Not like it's a white wine for a half an hour, but put the bottle on ice for 5 minutes. And if you drop that 5 or 6 degrees, isn't that a huge difference in the way you'll enjoy the red wine now?
It is. Oh, it is. All the flavors come into balance. And as you said, you know, too hot and all that you smell is the alcohol.
Yeah.
So, you know, wine should be refreshing, whether mm-hmm. it's red or white. And similarly, I would do that test that you're mentioning with a white wine. So especially if you see that bottle and it's just covered in condensation, like it's been hauled out of a really cold fridge, touch that too and see if the wine actually needs to come up a bit mm-hmm. in temperature.
Well, and the other thing though is what's funny is if a wine is 3 degrees too hot, it really can ruin it. But if it's 7 degrees too cold, it first of all, it can still be great if it's a couple of degrees too cold. And when you pour it in your glass, even if it's 10 degrees too cold or 12 degrees too cold, it's going to warm up in the glass in 5 minutes.
And don't be afraid to ask the sommelier to leave your white wine on the table and not put it back on ice. There are a lot of white wines that drink better at 55 even 58 degrees than they do at that 45 or even colder sometimes if they come out of a wine
and
cellar.
If the wine comes up a little cooler than you want, that's okay. Don't blame the restaurant. That's fine. That means it was because it should be stored cool.
Sure.
And you let it come up. But if the wine comes out warmer than you want, well, that can be a bit of an issue.
Well, I just want to give one more piece of advice before we go to our next break, and that is, you know, sommeliers are very different, just like all segments of the population. Some of them are very helpful. Some of them are less helpful. If you ask to put your red wine on ice and your sommelier gives you a dirty look, stop taking his advice.
Right. That's exactly right. But Natalie McLean is someone whose advice you should always take, and we've got more of it for you, especially as it revolves around summer parties and maybe even summer weddings when we come back from the break. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and Dave Austin, Catherine Lombardi. We're with our friend Natalie McLean. Natalie's become a regular contributor to the show. She's one of the world's top wine and food writers. You have touched on recently, Natalie, and you have a newsletter that you can find out by going to natdecamps.com. It's a great wine newsletter. But we've talked about recently one of my pet peeves. We go to a lot of weddings in the summertime, and one of the things we kill ourselves over at both weddings and on New Year's Eve is if people want to do a champagne toast, we push it till the very last minute, and then we fill all the glasses of champagne or half a glass of champagne or whatever the host wants, and then we run them over to people, whether it's right before the champagne toast or right at midnight on New Year's Eve, or it's right before the best man gives a toast at a wedding. We just kill ourselves. It takes every staff member off the floor for 15 minutes. But I think when you do a champagne toast, it can't be good luck to do what most restaurants do, which is they pour the champagne as the guests are arriving, or an hour before the guests arrive.
6 days before you got there.
So what most weddings are toasted with, a warm glass of flat champagne.
Congratulations. Yay. Start your life.
Yeah, hope the marriage goes better.
So what is your advice for serving champagne at weddings and at summer parties and things like that? Are we crazy to be so focused on making sure your champagne is chilled and bubbly?
Well, you know, I do think champagne's better enjoyed cold. As you know, as bubbly warms up, it loses its effervescence, and it's just not a great drink, I think. It's not as refreshing. But you're right, the logistics can be tough on that in terms of getting everyone topped up. That's why, you know, I prefer dinners that start with the toast, so that, you know, everybody may be milling around at the reception, then they come in, sit down, let's do the toast first while the bubbly is cold, fresh, and bubbly. I think that works well, at least the weddings I've been to. That's been a nice way to start. But the only other advice I'd have for people when it comes to weddings and bubbly is that you don't have to serve French champagne. There's so many choices out there in terms of bubblies from other regions around the world that are half or a third of the price and just as delicious.
Well, there's some great cavas from Spain, and obviously California has some sparkling ones.
Or from the Loire Valley, or you know, wherever.
Generally, I'll give advice to people who are planning a wedding or planning a large event with lots of family members. And that advice is almost always, don't blow your whole budget on the wine or the sparkling wine. And I know you kind of feel the same way, Natalie, about, you know, some of the people at your party are going to really appreciate it, but most of the people at your party probably won't. Are you better off in the middle, at the low end, at the high end? What do you think about that, Nat?
I would stick to the mid-range. I agree that not everybody appreciates wine, but I've also been to weddings where there was some pretty dreadful stuff. So, you know, I think if you hit right in the middle, you can choose bubblies from other countries that are more value-priced than, say, French champagne. And then with the wines, there's so many great values out there these days, whether it's from Chile or Australia or lesser-known regions of California. You can really get some good stuff in the, you know, the $10 to $12 range even.
So your advice is to not serve the top of the line, but avoid the plonk as well.
But it should at least be made from grapes.
Exactly. Yeah, that helps. That really helps.
Now, Mark and I are huge fans of toasting. I'm more than Mark. We used to belong to a lunch club called the Red Meat Club with a bunch of foodie friends of ours. For 10 years we would go, and we'd have lunch on the second Monday of every month, and every member present, sometimes up to 40 people, would have to give a toast, beginning with the newest member. And so we got pretty creative with our toasts. Do you think toasting is important with wines, just at weddings and other venues as well? Do you have any good toasts for us, Natalie?
Yeah, I love making toasts because I think it just seals the celebration. It's like the bow on the present, and it's a beautiful way for people to come together. And really, you know, you look into each other's eyes. You're there. It's a symbol of unity, and that's what toasting was in the old days. People would literally clink their glasses to make sure the wine spilled a little bit into each other's cup.
Aww.
Yeah. Well, and they were also making sure they weren't poisoning each other, but that's another issue. But these days, it's all friendly. So I think a toast is a great way to start any celebration, and I have a few favorite toasts. I have a couple for weddings. I have one just for friendship. Would you like me to share any
or
all?
Sure, please. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, here's a couple, two short ones for weddings. The first one is, here's to the bride who is to be. Here's to the groom she'll wed. May all their troubles be light as bubbles or the feathers that make up their bed.
Oh,
very nice.
What if they have a campaign theme?
What if they have a foam mattress? I'm sorry, I'm a party pooper. Next.
A shorter one, still on the sort of the bubbly theme, is may your joys be as deep as the ocean and your cares as light as its foam. That's just a really short one. We want to get on with the meal.
Very nice.
The bubbly is getting warm. And then I really like this one, just when you get together with friends. And it doesn't have to be a formal dinner. It's just, I don't know, I just think it's nice. So, may friendship like wine improve as time advances, and may we always have old wine, old friends, and young cares.
Oh, I like the old here's mud in your eye, but those are those are kind of nice too. Hey Natalie, I think we need to leave it there, and I'm sorry I could always talk to you every time we do a show with you. I think we should do two parters and do a two show with you. But will you come back and join us again in a couple of months and talk about the wines of fall maybe?
Absolutely, good theme.
That's great.
Great,
it's
thanks.
Been super to have you.
Thanks so much, Natalie.
Great chatting with you both guys.
The website is natdecanse.com. Natalie's book is Red, White, and Drunk All Over: A Wine Soaked Journey from Grape to Glass. You can find her website through ours at restaurantguysradio.com, or just go there yourself. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. This is Mark Francis. During the break, we were kidding around, and all the toasts we've had. Toasts can be very funny. A guy who gives a funny toast, I think, is great. And the other thing I'm not at all shy about doing if I'm out with a bunch of people is making everyone at the table give a toast. And, like, some people panic and they think about it for, like, 45 minutes. Uh-huh. And then I like that a lot.
I remember the toast I gave at my brother's wedding. The beginning of the toast. I gave a very sincere and serious toast afterwards. But the toast I gave at the beginning of my brother's wedding was, you know, my brother Chris, there's nothing I wouldn't do for him. And there's nothing he wouldn't do for me. And we spent the last 25 years doing nothing for each other. Then I gave a more serious, sincere toast.
My favorite toast was at a Red Meat Club meeting. A guy stood up and he gave a toast. I think he says it was Gaelic. I think it was Pig Gaelic.
Do they have that? Is that a thing, Pig Gaelic?
Maybe in Scotland. But he was of Scottish descent, not Irish. And he said,
I think he might have just been drunk,
and
Francis.
Could have been. Okay. Could have been. But I like the toast nonetheless, and I've always remembered it. We're talking years ago. And he said, and the toast was, here's Teus, was like us, gay few, and they're dead. I really, really enjoyed that toast.
Yeah, I think that sometimes people take toast too seriously, and occasionally people take toast too lightly.
Yeah, not seriously enough.
I am a big fan of, you know, at a wedding or something like that. It's okay to say some humorous things, and some people, you know, I've been to some weddings where they've said some hysterical, great, funny things. But, you know, I think it's important, especially at a wedding, to also say something nice at the same time. So you need to temper those comments a little bit.
Unless you're the ex-boyfriend. But, you know, your opportunity to say something not nice is speak now or forever hold
right,
your peace.
Right, exactly. So, you're supposed to be holding your peace.
By the time you got to the toast, you're already holding your peace.
So this is Mark Pascal saying, à santé.
And this is Francis Schott saying, sláinte. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12.